What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
1-833-288-EWTN.
What's stopping
you? I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
1-833-288-3986.
What's stopping you?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
What's stopping you? This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Looky, looky, we made it to Friday. How about that? Welcome again to Call to Communion here on EWTN. It's the program for our non-Catholic brothers and sisters. If you have a question about the Catholic faith, please consider us as a primary resource to get that question answered, well, once and for all. Here's our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. I do recommend, because it's Friday and the phones fill up rather quickly, call early in the hour, 833-288-EWTN. Outside North America, please dial 1 and then 205-271-2985. You can also text the letters EWTN to 58177. Wait for our response, and then text us your first name and your brief question. Message and data rates may apply. You can also shoot us an email if you prefer that. The address is ctc@ewtn.com. Charles Beery is our producer. Matt Kabinski is our phone screener. Rich Jesse handling social media for us. He is on the J-O-B there if you want to ask a question via YouTube or Facebook. We're streaming on both those platforms right now. Just put your question in the comments box. Again, the phone number, 833-288-EWTN. I'm Tom Price, along with Dr. David Anders.
Tom, how are you today?
Very well. How are you, my friend?
You know, I'm doing decent. Thank you.
So is Father's Day, you know, Father's Day is kind of a big deal, especially here in the United States. Do you have anything planned, or are you at the mercy of the family?
You know, it feels strangely self-serving to ask what we have in view.
It does.
So I think I'm going to wait and be surprised or not surprised, as the case may be. How about you, Tom?
You know, we actually talked about getting out of town for a couple of days. And then at the end of the day, we just decided whatever happens, happens.
There you go.
And so I think it's a good way to proceed here. Here's a question from someone else who's also named David. This David says, Dr. Anders, please help me to understand and reconcile James 2:14-26, faith and works, with Romans 4, Abraham justified by faith and inheritance through faith. So does Jesus, therefore God, expect faith and works? Thanks, David.
Okay, thanks. I really appreciate the question. So there's a lot of things, actually, we have to untangle here. And a real critical one is, what is the meaning of the term justification? Right, and what's in view, and what is meant by works, for that matter, and for that matter, what's meant by faith. So the context of these remarks, especially in Romans, Paul is addressing the situation of first century Christians, where unexpected by many of the disciples, the Gentile portion of the emergent Christian church is bigger and more vigorous than people had anticipated, and it is creating problems within early Christianity, because the original disciples are Jews. They understand Jesus as the Messiah of the Jews. It has not occurred to them that they would in any way change their identity as Jews. Here come Gentiles. Do they need to become Jews? And there were many people who thought the answer to that question was yes, that in order to really enter into the covenant promises with Abraham, Moses, and the rest, that they should also become Jews, children of Israel, and live according to the covenant terms, covenant laws. And St. Paul's position was no. They are heirs to the promises to Abraham, but as Gentiles. They don't actually have to become ethnically Jews and follow Jewish rituals in order to participate. They do so by faith alone. And justification in this context, essentially for Paul, means how is it that God accounts people members of his covenant family? Right, so it's not uniquely a question about who goes to heaven when they die. It's a question about ecclesial identity. And Paul's position is that you get counted as a member of God's covenant family in virtue of your faith in Jesus, not by your adherence to the rituals of the Mosaic Code. Now, when it comes to the who goes to heaven when they die question, Paul's position was that when you have faith in Christ, that God gives you the gift of his Holy Spirit, he grants you his grace, and that grace transforms you inwardly such that you now effectively obey the heart and soul of the law, namely love of God and love of neighbor, even though you're not messing around with the ritual aspects like circumcision or the dietary code. And so in Paul's language, the gift of the Spirit enables you to walk with the Spirit, and this love poured into your heart is the fulfillment of the law, which after all boils down to the love of God and neighbor. So it's in that manner that faith saves rather than works of the law, because faith is what brings the gift of the Spirit, which enables us to love, which enables God to say, well done, good and faithful servant. Now, there was a misinterpretation of Paul in the first century, as later, that that Paul's rejection of the Mosaic law as the marker of covenant identity and salvation meant that one didn't have to do anything, that there was no moral component to the question of relationship to God at all. That misinterpretation is what James is countering. That no, that and he points to the example of Abraham, that what faithfulness meant for Abraham was getting up and doing what God said. God said, "Leave your home in Ur of the Chaldeans, uh-huh. Go to the land that I will show you, and I'll make your name great." Abraham didn't say, "That sounds great to me, God," and then just sit back on the couch and flip on Netflix. He actually did exactly what he's told. He got up and he obeyed God and he followed him. So it's faithfulness really is the idea, rather than say Jewish ethnic identity or ritual behaviors that constitute our bond of union with God. And that's what James points out. So there really is zero conflict between James and St. Paul in terms of their conception of salvation. And it is that through faith, God gives us the grace to enable us to fulfill the spirit of the law, namely love of God and neighbor, whereby God can say, well done, good and faithful servant.
All right. Listener David, thank you so much for your question. And if you would like to send us an email for a future show, that email address is ctc@ewtn.com, ctc@ewtn.com. We usually try to tackle one or two emails on each of our live programs, and then once a month or so, we will dip into the mailbag and shake it loose and let everything fall out of there, and we'll do a whole bunch of emails about once a month or so. Now, again, the address ctc@ewtn.com. In a moment, we're going to be talking with Ruben, a first-time caller from Southern California, also David, and a couple lines open for you. As we said, because it is Friday, we recommend that you call early, 833-288-EWTN. Grab a line, 833-288-3986. Call to communion on this Friday afternoon here on EWTN. It's Call to Communion with Dr. David Andrews here on EWTN Radio. Our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Something kind of crept up on me here. I didn't even realize today is Flag Day, June 14th. But you know what? We have got something for you, a patriotic mug. You can use it on Flag Day, July 4th. You can use it Veterans Day, Memorial Day, any day. It's an 11-ounce ceramic mug featuring an image of a cross and God Bless America with the American flag as the background. Now, this beautiful mug is microwave and dishwasher safe, making warming up and cleaning up real easy. Normally, these sell for $10 each. You can now buy two or more at a discounted price of $9 each. Get several for gifts. Fill them with special treats or mementos. Make someone's day truly special. The God Bless America mug. It's an 11-ounce mug. Check it out right now at EWTNRC.com. Buy Catholic, shop Catholic. EWTNRC.com. All right, if you're ready now, let's go to the phones at 833-288-EWTN, beginning with Ruben, first-time caller from Southern California, listening on YouTube. Hey there, Ruben. What's on your mind today, sir?
How's it going? Thank you guys for having me.
Sure.
So the situation I've been running into recently, I'm kind of new to the faith. I'm a recent convert, and I've been running into a lot of Hebrew Israelites on my commute to work lately. And one thing that they always kind of try to, corner me in is the changing of the Sabbath. They say that the original Sabbath was Saturday. And I understand that you know, a lot of the old prophecy was fulfilled and we don't fall under old law, but I kind of would like some kind of, you know, some kind of information to help settle me on why we do celebrate on this Sunday
yeah,
now.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. I really appreciate it. Let me say a word just briefly about Black Hebrew Israelitism, because it's a modern movement that shares something in common with many similar movements throughout history. That is the claim to be ethnically descended from the lost tribes of Israel. And you will find, if you look around the globe, that the lost tribes of Israel really seem to have gotten around, right? Because there are groups that claim that Native Americans are descendants of the lost tribes of Israel. There are groups that claim that the Maori of the Australasian islands are descendants of the lost tribes of Israel. The Limba people are descendants of the lost tribes of Israel. There are some theories that have even speculated that the Japanese are descended from the lost tribes of Israel. I used to have the blessing to run around with a lot of Korean Christians. There's even a version of Korean Israelitism.
Wow.
And there's also such a thing as British Israelitism, and I'm sure I haven't covered half the groups. There are also various ethnic tribes in Afghanistan and India that claim to be descendants of the lost tribes of Israel. So pretty much if you're a kind of, you know, marginalized, disaffected minority culture someplace throughout the world and you've come into contact with the biblical narrative, there's going to be somebody from your group that claims that you're a descendant of the lost tribes of Israel. And so, you know, from my way of looking at it, I mean, it's just sort of one of a piece for this kind of thing. And as such, the claim to have kind of insider status and a kind of, you know, specialized, privileged perspective on the biblical narrative that sets their group apart from the mainstream of Christian or Judeo-Christian history is what gives these kinds of movements their appeal. It's the same thing that powers the conspiracy theory, you know, the idea that I and my little tiny sect have got the key to unlock the mystery that has everybody else held in thrall, but we see the truth.
I'm on the inside.
I'm on the inside, you know. And that's that temptation, you know, to be in the inner ring and to have the secret key and to know the mystic language and have the hat and the funny handshake and all that. It's it's a pervasive tendency. It's a spiritual temptation that I think really runs counter to humanity's rational well-being, which really can be found in more universal values like the virtues of justice and fortitude and temperance and so forth. And those are things that, you know, you don't have to be a part of the, you know, the secret mystic group with the secret handshake to have. They're part of the patrimony of the human race. And it helps us avoid both suspicion towards our neighbors and really disdain towards people that are outside our group, as well as the pride and the blindness of pride that can come into play with that kind of ethnic ethnocentrism. Now, that being said, to the claim that the Christian church changed or got rid of the Sabbath, I would say, well, no, we didn't. Like, last time I checked, I've got a synagogue right down the hill from my house. And, you know, there are a lot of Orthodox Jews that live in my personal neighborhood. And every Saturday, I get in my car, drive to the grocery store, and there are whole families of Orthodox Jews. You know, the women all wear long skirts and
sure.
have long sleeves down to their you know, to their wrists. And
uh-huh.
the men typically wear black. And there they go, traipsing down the road to synagogue on Saturday. That's the synagogue. That's the Sabbath.
Sure.
It's the day that God commanded the Jews to rest from work. They're still doing that.
Yep.
The Christian church never told them to stop doing that. Well, maybe in some select places they did. But, I mean, in principle, nothing in Christianity prevents or stops or has anything to do with whether or not Jews refrain from work on Saturday. We didn't change that.
Nope.
What we do is a completely different category. Jesus rose from the dead on Sunday, the first day of the week. Go back to the New Testament, you'll find that Christians met on the first day of the week to celebrate the Lord's resurrection, to break bread, and in sacred scripture, that's a kind of euphemism for the Eucharist,
mm-hmm.
to offer prayers and then go about their business. We've been doing that since the first century. Now, when the earliest Christians were Jews, you know what they did? They went to synagogue on Saturday. They refrained from work. And then on Sunday morning, they got up and celebrated the Eucharist and went about their business. Now, when Gentiles became Christians, the question, well, should they go to synagogue on Saturday too and follow other Jewish ritual, was raised. And the church said, no, they're Gentiles. Let them keep doing what they're doing.
Yeah.
And we'll keep on celebrating the Lord's Day on Sunday. So the confusion comes in with the idea that that Sunday is nothing other than the Sabbath kicked one day forward in the calendar, or maybe one day back in the calendar, I should say.
Mm.
But they're not, because the Sabbath commandment is do no work. But the Sunday principle is offer the sacrifice of the Eucharist. It's not the same thing.
Nope.
It's not the same thing. Now, it is, as a matter of course, many Christians refrain from work on Sunday so that they can commit the day to worship and time with their families. But the essence of Sunday is not refraining from work, which is the essence of the Sabbath commandment. The essence of Sunday is gathering in community to offer the sacrifice of the Eucharist and to say prayers to God in commemoration of Jesus' resurrection. We didn't change the Sabbath. It's still on Saturday.
Okay. And what about this question about, do we change the name of Jesus?
No. No, it's called translation.
Ah.
So, you know, if you spoke to Jesus in Hebrew or Aramaic and you lived in the first century, you would have called him Yeshua. But the Greek, the authors of the Greek New Testament, and these are the only scriptures we have of Jesus, use Jesus, which is the Greek transliteration of Yeshua.
Mm.
And when then Greek gets translated into modern languages, in English, that's Jesus. That's just called translation. That's all that is. I were speaking Aramaic, I'd call him Yeshua. But I don't speak Aramaic, so I call him Jesus.
Very good. Reuben, is that helpful for you, sir?
Yeah, you know what? I love that. I just needed something to kind of cement me. I need somebody smarter than me to say. Thank you.
Hey, thank you.
Glad we can help you out with that, Reuben. Appreciate your call today from Southern California. That opens up a line for you right now at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Before we let Reuben go, our screener Matt points out that Nigeria's Igbo people also believe they were the lost tribes.
I'm feeling kind of left out. Could we be the lost tribes for a week?
Let's do it. Maybe we could start a convention or something.
We have the lost tribes convention.
I like it. Let's go to Emmanuel in Tulsa, listening on the great Oklahoma Catholic Broadcasting. Emmanuel, happy Friday to you. What's on your mind today, sir?
Happy Friday. Thank you. And thank you so much for your work, Dr. David, and the whole Catholic Answers team. I'm a big fan.
Very well. How can we help you today?
So my wife and I recently had a stillbirth or a miscarriage. And my question is, before this child died, my wife, who was ill in the hospital and admitted, had received the sacrament of the anointing of the sick. Does that sacrament confer any graces to the child?
Yeah,
and
thank
where
you.
I'm going with that is, then okay,
yeah,
you already have the answer.
Yeah, I got it. Thank you so much. And listen, my sincere condolences on this loss, and I know how painful that can be, and I'm very, very, very sorry. And you please extend that to your wife as well. I know that's tragic, and I'm very sorry that happened. So here is the good news about the Catholic faith. It is a doctrine of the Catholic faith that God gives sufficient grace for salvation to every soul, every single one. And God knows when we're going to die. And the teaching of the Catholic faith is that before we die, God offers grace sufficient to bring us to salvation to every soul. Now, as you know, an unborn baby is a distinct soul. God knows that that child is going to die, you know, in this case, before even birth. And so the grace that's sufficient for that child to be saved is a grace that, in principle, cannot require conscious participation, because the child's incapable of conscious participation. So if he gave grace that would be the kind of grace appropriate for an adult, which does require conscious participation on our part, that would not be sufficient for that child, because it's something the child's incapable of. So I don't know what the grace that an unborn child gets is like. because the faith doesn't tell us that specifically, but I know that that child receives grace sufficient for that child to be saved in that child's situation, which, to my way of thinking, must be grace that does not require a fully conscious, explicit participation, because that's something the child's incapable of. It's for these kinds of reasons that the church's disposition towards the miscarried child is one of confident hope in their salvation. Now, to the question, did the sacrament of anointing have anything to do with that? Well, as I'm sure you know, the sacrament of anointing is offered for a particular person, and in this case, it was offered to the mother. So we have the assurance of grace given to the mother. Does it have any downstream consequences, as it were, for the child? None that we know of. None that the church affirms as a part of Catholic doctrine. Does that mean that we know for a fact no additional graces were given to the child? Of course we don't know that. But again, the overall position is one of confident hope in the salvation of this child who has no personal sin, no actual sin, and the promise of God that that child received all the grace sufficient for his or her salvation.
And Manuel, thank you so much for your call from Tulsa. We do appreciate hearing from you today here on EWTN's Call to Communion with Dr. David Andrews. Quick question here from Ivy watching us on YouTube. Is it okay to take communion more than once a day? And is it okay for priests to quit the priesthood?
Okay, thank you so much. So it is allowed for a Catholic to receive Holy Communion more than once in a day, although there are some restrictions on it. The second communion should be in the context of a Mass, where one attends the whole Mass,
mm-hmm.
So that's your requirement. So you shouldn't go to communion in the morning, say, and then run receive communion at your friend's bedside three times. You know, that's inappropriate.
Yeah.
You can go to a second communion at a second Mass where you go to the whole Mass.
Okay. And then the other question
is it okay for a priest to leave the priesthood?
Yeah.
Well, it's kind of like asking, is it okay for a spouse to leave a marriage? And the answer is it really depends. So when a person marries, they marry with the intent to stay married forever, and you know, till death do us part is the promise through sickness and in health and better and worse and rich and poor and all that stuff. But sometimes one party makes that promise impossible to fulfill. Let's say you have a woman who's beginning to be physically abused by her addicted husband, who has himself apostatized, and it is completely not safe for her to remain in the same house, and she has no choice but to seek the protection of civil divorce to save her life or the life of her children. No fault pertains. There's no fault attaching to that decision on her part. She has to. She has no choice. Okay. It can happen in similar, it's a kind of an analogy that while when one is ordained a priest, one is a priest forever, and one doesn't ever stop being a priest, there could be some circumstance in the life of a priest where the most rational decision all around is for this individual priest to be laicized. Now, the most obvious case is when a priest goes bad, and that happens, right? Some priest deviates in a grotesque way from his vows, say, you know, conspicuously from his vow of celibacy, for example, and creates scandal in the church and is shown to be unsafe. Well, then the church, kind of like the injured spouse, has no choice but to separate this man from active priesthood. Can't take away the sacrament of ordination. Once it's given, it can never be removed. But the faculties to exercise that sacrament in the life of the Christian faithful have to be removed for the safety of the congregation.
Ivy, thanks so much for checking in via YouTube this afternoon. In a moment, we're going to talk with, looks like, Michael in Tulsa, listening on the EWTN app. A couple lines open available for you right now. Don't delay. Call in today, as John Ed Williams says. 833-288-EWTN, 833-288-3986. It's called a communion on this Friday afternoon here on EWTN. Still time for your phone calls, but I'm going to have to limit things pretty quickly here because We don't want to have, you know, five people on hold and then we can't get to them. So now's the time to call 833-288-EWT. And if you have a question for Dr. David Anders, 833-288-3986. David in Louisiana called, couldn't stay on the line, but left us with this question. Could you please define eternity and end of time and how some folks seem to use these two terms interchangeably?
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate the question. So eternity in Catholic theology is something that can be predicated only of God.
Okay.
Right. It is literally outside of time. Right. Time is a creature that exists as a dimension within the space-time continuum, we now understand. And God being the source of everything else that exists is the primary cause of time itself. And so God is atemporal. He doesn't exist on a timeline. He doesn't have a beginning or an end. He doesn't experience any kind of extension either in space or in time. And so eternity as such can be predicated only of God. Usually when people talk about the end of time, they're talking about the end of this particular space-time universe. Right? The world system that we currently inhabit of our planet and the solar system, and you know, the gravity and giraffes and platypuses and things of that sort. And at least in Christian eschatology, the end of the world, the end of this world, is not the end of time. It's not the end of temporal existence. And technically, the Christian view of the afterlife is not eternity, but everlasting life. They're not the same. Everlasting life is a temporal existence of never-ending sequence. Eternity, again, is something predicable only of God.
Very good. And thanks for working in the platypuses.
I like platypuses. Oh,
they're fantastic. So there you go. David in Louisiana, thanks so much for your question. Here is a question in our almost 10 years on the air. I don't think we've ever received anything like this. This is from EB. Dr. Anders, do you watch horror movies? Or can I ask what sort of horror movies do you prefer watching?
Okay, thanks. I really appreciate the question. So it raises a question about the definition of the genre.
Okay.
Okay. And I think you can define horror in two different ways. The more common form of horror film is really not horror. It's really disgust and fear. And you know, what the director does is he'll throw all kinds of disturbing images on the screen of blood and guts and gore, and sometimes, you know, really, really disturbing and questionable sexuality. And the idea is to just get a disgust response and a startle response out of the audience. And so part of the genre is, you know, there's a monster and you go around a corner and he's not there. And there's a monster and you go around a corner and he's not there. And there's a monster and you go around the corner and you're like, he's not going to be there this time. And then he's there.
Yeah,
you know? And then you
yeah.
get your head ripped off, right? And that sort of thing doesn't do much for me, honestly. It's just I'd rather spend my time watching other stuff. And I'm a fan of sci-fi and fantasy by and
sure.
large, you know, and a good action film now and then, and suspense. There's another way of conceiving of the nature of horror, and that is a kind of existential shock and awe that calls all of one's categories into question. When one is confronted with the mystery of the absolute in a way that doesn't bring comfort like the confrontation with God might. I mean, God can be terrifying and scary, but also one is ultimately homed and grounded within a confrontation of God. It can be the opposite of that. It can be a confrontation of the abyss where my sense of scale and significance are reduced to something infinitesimal and my grasp on reality is shaken. And that's true horror, and it doesn't have to have the grotesque and sexualized elements that are so common in the quote-unquote horror movies.
Mm.
So to give you an example of the genre, I can't think of a film right now, but in literature, the novels of H.P. Lovecraft, for example, that is all they did. That's all they did. The whole point of Lovecraft was that humanity thought it had a grip on reality and encounters something on such a scale and so foreign and alien that suddenly the sense of significance, one's grip on things is totally upended, and one is left in a state of radical existential confusion. And, you know, Lovecraft was an atheist, and his objectives were atheistic, and they were not at all edifying. But I do think that that kind of horror, that conception of horror, being essentially more metaphysical and spiritual, does have something of value to a Christian audience. Mm. And in that there is something like that in the confrontation with holiness. And we see it, say, in Isaiah's theophany in Isaiah chapter 6, when he thinks he has a grasp on God, and then one day he sees God, and his response is to go, gulp.
Yeah.
You know, I'm toast. Or the end of the book of Job, I think, is it could come right out of a Lovecraft novel, right? Job is all about a man and his companions who think they have a grasp on reality, and they keep trying to spin out explanations for Job's existential situation. And when God finally appears, he gives no answer but himself. He doesn't actually answer any of Job's intellectual questions. He just confronts Job with the awesome reality of his own being. And Job's response is, now I understand. What do you understand exactly? You know, only your position in the relative scale of the universe. That's about all he understands, right?
Wow.
But it sets everything else in context. So I do think that kind of horror can have a certain kind of value. Although, again, just for my money, I'd rather read a Terry Pratchett novel.
There you go.
You know,
pretty fascinating question, though.
It's a great question.
EB, thank you so much for sending that to us. Let us go to Richard now in Minnesota, listening on Ave Maria Radio. Richard, what's on your mind today, sir?
Yes, thank you. Thank you guys for your show. And the question that I have today has to do with punishment for sin. And specifically, contrast between King David and his sin with Bathsheba, and then, of course, the man that was born blind that Jesus forgave, whom his disciples, or not forgave, he healed. So I know there's always questions that I have from other people, like, why does God punish us for somebody else's sin? Does he?
Yeah, it's a great question. I really appreciate the question. So, in order to answer the question, we really have to look at the larger question of the interpretation of the Old Testament. And to move into the topic, I'd like to point something out about the Old Testament, and that is that the Old Testament gives diametrically opposite answers to this question. And so in the book of Deuteronomy chapter 5, for example, God says, I am a jealous God, and I will visit the curse of the father's sins upon the children to the third and fourth generation. It just says it.
Yeah.
Right? But then there's Ezekiel 18, which happens to be in the same Bible, where God says, I absolutely will not visit the sins of the fathers upon the children.
Hmm.
So which is it? Which is it? And it's not only this issue, but there are other issues. Again, Deuteronomy, larger than the children question, seems to say that temporal blessings and curses flow from obedience or disobedience to God's commands. So obey and you'll have fields full of fruit. You know, you'll have fertile wives and lots of sons will go up around your table and you'll have lots of cattle and you'll have victory over your enemies, yada, yada, yada. A few minutes ago, we were talking about the book of Job. Job did all those things. God took away the wives, took away the children, took away the cattle, took away the houses. Well, which is it? Is it Deuteronomy or is it Job? And I could, there's several other points like that that I could raise for you. Now, when you get to the New Testament, Jesus and St. Paul seem to do a rather radical thing with the Old Testament. That is to say, they don't take it at face value. And a prime example of this would be Matthew chapter 19. When the Pharisees ask Jesus if a man can divorce his wife for any reason, which the book of Deuteronomy manifestly says he can do. And Jesus says, no, he cannot. And they said, well, then why does Deuteronomy say that he can? And in effect, Jesus says, well, Deuteronomy's wrong. What he says was Moses allowed this because of the hardness of your heart. But it wasn't like that from the beginning, and what God has joined together, man can't separate. So he just relativized one part of the Old Testament, interpreting it in light of another, but ultimately interpreting it in accord with his higher principle of the value of love. So he selectively picks what he thinks is the highest principle of the Old Testament and uses it to interpret and relativize other passages of the Old Testament. That's his hermeneutical system. And so that's how we do the Old Testament. And we read it with these higher spiritual principles in mind. We relativize the other portions, and we allegorize them and see them as basically pointing us toward their fulfillment in Jesus. When it comes to the question of fathers and their sons, it is evident to me, and I think to all of us, that you know that a parent and the bad choices of a parent can absolutely bring wreck and ruin on the lives of their children and grandchildren. Absolutely. You know, I remember one time reading a genealogy of Jonathan Edwards' family, and it just reads like, you know, senator, congressman, governor, college president, you know, academic, scientist, one after another after another after another for generation upon generation. Mm. And in the particular article I was reading, it contrasted Edwards' genealogy with that of another person whose lineage went back to the Mayflower, and it was basically, you know, criminality and reprobate after criminality and reprobate, you know, for generations. And the point was how these things can get embedded in family structures and get passed. There's no doubt that happens. I mean, if you're born into a family of addicts, your life is going to be very different than if you're born into a family of cardiothoracic surgeons, right? It's just, you're just going to be different. Right? Sure. So that's just manifestly obvious. But when it comes to the question of personal moral responsibility, each man stands or falls on his own. And for Jesus, the teaching that we should not judge that an individual man's suffering is necessarily a result of his bad moral behavior or that of his parents. Sometimes these things just happen for God's own inscrutable purposes. That's clearly Jesus's point of view and the one that we as Christians should adopt.
There you go, Richard. Appreciate your call. Thank you so much for checking in from Minnesota. Call to Communion here on EWTN. We can probably get in one or maybe two more phone calls at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Earlier, we were talking about the upcoming Father's Day, which is Sunday, and both of our fathers have passed on. But I know, David, you have got some great memories of Father's Days of the past.
So my dad was far and away the greatest positive moral influence and any other kind of influence you'd ever want to imagine on my life. And he was very unlike me in many ways. I'm kind of an emotional roller coaster, but he was just solid as a rock. He had the emotional range, you know, of a piece of flint. but in consequence, he was totally reliable, and I could rely on him my entire life, knowing that if I ever needed the shirt off his back, it was available to me. And there was never a time when he didn't give me his full attention. What a gift that was. If I had something to say, if I had something a need, if I just wanted to be with him, he would put down whatever it was he was doing, no matter how important, and there I was, you know, the most important thing in his life at that moment. And my dad was a very busy attorney, and if you called his office, he would usually answer the phone in the busy attorney dad voice, which was something along the lines of, "Hello?" And he would answer the phone that way, and I would say, "Hi, Dad, it's me." And suddenly, "Hello?" would turn into, "Oh, hi, Dave." And the whole demeanor would change. And I knew that I was the most important thing in the world to him, you know. And that just meant the world to me. The other thing that my dad did was that I knew that he could lose his reputation, his business, his law practice, and every friend he had, every bone in his body, you name it. You could take everything away from that man. And whatever happened to him, no matter what suffering was thrown at him, the one thing he would never, ever, 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 ever do was turn his back on his wife. That his attitude towards marital fidelity was, divorce your wife and go to hell. Period. End of paragraph. No questions asked. And he's like, I don't care what happens to you. You stay faithful to your family. And as a child, I knew that in my bones. I knew that my parents' marriage was as solid as a rock, no matter what. My mother used to say, "Murder maybe, divorce never." You know, and what a gift that was in my family to have that kind of solid rock. And my dad rarely gave me advice. You know, he lived his faith and his life and his virtues in front of me. He did offer me basically one piece of advice consistently throughout life, and it's kind of a trifecta of advice, maybe a quadrifecta. What is this? He would say, "Anders, David, study the liberal arts."
Yeah.
I guess it's a trifecta. Study the liberal arts. Be faithful to your wife, and whatever you do, never co-sign alone.
Solid.
And I've followed those three.
Good man. Very good. And I'm sure that has impacted your life as a father yourself.
Well, my aspiration is to be half the dad my dad was, right?
Yeah. I'm sure you've surpassed that already.
Working on it.
Call to Communion here on EWTN. This is an email from Megan. I've been listening to your show. It's been very helpful for me. Thank you. I was wondering if you would be willing to talk about how someone can honor an absent parent, actually paternal abandonment, who is not open to reconciliation. He and his extended family are Catholics in staff positions within the church. This has left me confused about what I am doing incorrectly. I've been searching for answers. I feel quite lost. I don't do drugs, steal, have mental health issues, etc. I'm gainfully employed, have a degree with honors, two wonderful children, and a supportive husband. If you could provide some direction here, it would be so helpful. I want to make sure I'm doing everything I can. Thank you, Megan.
Yeah, thanks. So let me get this straight. Do I understand it that Megan has a parent who works for the church,
yep,
but will have nothing to do with Megan?
That's correct.
All right. Why on God's green earth would you think this is your fault? I mean, I'm a parent. I've got five kids and two grandkids. The amount of things that my kids have done to me, right, or that I did to my parents, that would alienate anybody else on the planet other than the parent, you know, it's astronomical. I mean, some of the ridiculous nonsense that I forced my parents through, you know.
Me too.
And the thought of abandoning my children, right, even in the face of their most absurd, insanities, it never occurs, right? That, I mean, they're my kids. I think, he who doesn't care for his family is worse than an infidel, St. Paul says.
Hmm.
That I don't think this is on you. This is just not on you. This is, I don't know what's up with this person, father or mother, but I can't conceive that it's your fault in any shape, form, or fashion. What does it mean to honor a person like that? Well, ideally, honoring your parent means a couple things. Most importantly, it means providing them with the access to the means of grace they need for their own salvation. So, you know, if they need to get to a Catholic priest, they need to get to the Catholic Church, they need funeral rites when they die and a mass for their soul. I mean, those are all things that you can do to the extent to which you're permitted.
Yeah.
You can pray for them, right? If your parents become aged and infirm and you have the ability to provide for their material comforts and well-being within kind of reasonable means, that's another thing you can do. What you're not obligated to do is to sign up for victimhood, right? And so, you know, you don't have to stand there and let another person verbally or physically abuse you. And if they're not willing to receive your love or affection, you're not obligated to give what you have no power to force reception of.
Sure.
Right? And by all means, please, please don't feel guilty about this. I think grief is an appropriate response, but not guilt.
Megan, thank you so much, and we hope that is helpful for you. Here's a question. This would be a good one for Mr. Peabody and Sherman getting into the Wayback Machine.
Oh, yeah.
So this is from Ryan. How were we supposed to live before Christ's teaching? More importantly, how are we to understand God from the beginning of time up until Christ?
Okay, thanks. I appreciate the question. The second one is easy to answer, at least at one level. God doesn't change, and so God is eternally exactly as God is eternally. And so, the best way to understand God is the way God is.
Okay.
As he's revealed to us in the Catholic faith and, honestly, through Catholic philosophy. Now, our capacity to grasp those truths has developed culturally over time, but God himself doesn't develop. He's just the same. How are you to follow Christ? How do you follow God before the coming of Christ? Well, one should follow the dictates of the natural law, the divine logos that is implanted in every human mind and every human nature. Again, our ability to formulate the principles of the natural law is something that is that develops culturally, and this is something the church fathers themselves recognized. So St. Irenaeus, for example, when answering the question, why did Christ become incarnate at the moment that he became incarnate as opposed to some other point in history, said that it was necessary that men be accustomed, be sort of acculturated to the divine logos. And what he meant by that is that things like philosophy, things like the rational conception of the universe, were things that needed to develop, right? In order for, so historians of the ancient world will sometimes talk about a major event called the Axial Age, called Jaspers, the German sociologist invented the term, and it's the recognition that someplace around the 8th century BC throughout the world, not just in one place, it could be in ancient Israel, in ancient Greece, in India, in China, you see a kind of parallel shift from a Bronze Age cosmology where the gods are sort of part of the space-time universe and made out of the same stuff as us. And so, you know, in the Babylonian creation myth, for example, the world is just made out of the dead body of a god. And the point of religious practice is really to kind of harness natural forces and powers in the service of my sort of day-to-day material needs, kind of get good crops out of Baal if I offer sacrifice, for example, that sort of thing. And you find a shift in religious consciousness where it becomes less about how do I manipulate the physical elements or appease the anger of the gods, and more how do I transform myself and my society to live a more just and decent human life. And so you'll see that in things like Socrates and Plato and Plato's Republic, which is definitely about social issues and psychological issues. Socrates' quest for wisdom and virtue, you'll find it in the Hebrew prophets. You'll find it in, say, the passage from the Rig Veda in Hinduism to the Upanishads. You'll find it in the development of Buddhism. You find it in the development of Taoism, you know, away from just, you know, pure pagan polytheistic religion that preceded that. So it's sort of a more rational conception of the human person. And the Church Fathers recognized that development, both within the Hebrew tradition as well as outside of it, was preparatory and necessary for the reception of the gospel in the ancient world, where Jesus was understood and received really as a kind of philosopher, one who was speaking to those universally recognized human needs. And so, you know, absolutely, yes, we have an obligation to follow the natural law and the leadings of the divine logos, but a recognition that that's something that did in fact develop historically up to the coming of Christ, which was essentially the fulfillment of man's universal spiritual aspirations and longings.
Very good. Thanks so much for that. And a quick question here from Lisa in South Dakota. I'm trying to find an example of the sin of pride according to the Catholic Church. Is feeling good about something you made or accomplished considered the sin of pride, such as doing embroidery or restoring an old car, fixing up old toys, and feeling like you did a good job? If not, does it become a sin of pride when we share our accomplishments with someone, as in showing a picture of what we made and, I guess, being proud that we were able to do it and it actually looks decent? Is it prideful because we don't give the glory to God? Instead, we take the praise.
Great question. No, that's not pride. So pride is really a disproportionate love of one's own honor to the exclusion of other goods and to the hurt of other people. So, you know, for example, Tom is an infinitely better lector than I am. He's just infinitely better than I am. Tom is like the super lector. I mean, he needs to show up wearing a cape and red boots to mass. He's so good at being a lector. He just has that perfect lector voice. And if I'm in a public worship space with Tom and somebody says, Anders, can you lector? I'm going to say, well, that's a really dumb choice. You know, you need to hire Tom here to do this job. He's much better at it. Pride would be me going, well, I need to take every opportunity to get in front of people and not let anybody else exercise their gifts. You know, that would be pride.
Okay.
But I hope very much that Tom appreciates the fact that God has given him a gift and he's very good at what he does, and that's something to be grateful for. And it's not something he should hide under his bushel, you know. His wife Adrienne's a singer, you know, and she wants to use that gift in public for the sake of the worship of God and the edification of the community. That's not pride. That's a desire to genuinely be useful with the gifts that one has given you. And if embroidery is your thing, well, by all means, just, you know, embroider till the cows come home, and you can use that as a gift to bless others and be happy about it. Feel good. You know, that experience of flow, you can lose yourself in a positive activity that has some objective values. One of the most meaningful things we do as human beings. Now, if you suddenly start insisting that only your embroidery counts and all other embroidery is poppycock and no one should look at it, you know, then that's pride.
Different story. Elisa in South Dakota, thank you so much for your email. And by the way, for the record, I do not recommend the boots or the red cape. It's just going to detract. Dr. David Anders, thank you, sir. Thank you so much. And don't forget, we do this program Monday through Friday here on EWTN Radio at 2 p.m. Eastern. Check out the podcast anytime by going to EWTN.com and then click on the radio box. And once you're there, look for the words Podcast Central. On behalf of our fantastic team, I'm Tom Price along with Dr. David Anders. Thanks for joining us. Hope that you have a wonderful weekend as well. We will see you on Monday for the Monday edition of Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders. Have that wonderful weekend. Happy Father's Day, everybody, and see you then. God bless.